This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Ask most women when and where they first read Our Bodies, Ourselves, and they will have an answer.
For example, in college for a class.
Or
as a teenager at a slumber party.
Or
at home in secret under the covers because my parents would have freaked out.
By the way, ask men too, and a lot of them will have an answer about when they first stole a glance at Our Bodies, Ourselves, because that's how revolutionary the book was.
Our Bodies, Ourselves began in 1971 as a pamphlet written by a group of women who met regularly in the basement of a Watertown Armenian church. With its plain-spoken writing and hand-drawn illustrations of female anatomy, the book sought to be radical by demystifying and de-radicalizing women's bodies.
As one reviewer put it, Our Bodies, Ourselves isn't so much a book as it is a transformative cultural event, one that helped push America from a place that looked like Mad Men to one that looked like Ms.
So we are talking about Our Bodies, Ourselves on the 40th anniversary of the groundbreaking book, how it helped evolve our understanding of women and their bodies, and how the book itself has evolved, or maybe perhaps still needs to as well. So listeners, have you read Our Bodies, Ourselves? What difference did it make to your life? And have you asked your daughter to read it too? And in a world where Google can give us a million answers in a microsecond to even the most intimate questions, what is the role of Our Bodies, Ourselves today? Why is it still relevant? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining me now in the studio is Judy Norsegian. 40 years ago, she was one of the original authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves. She has been with the organization ever since and is now executive director of the Watertown-based group Our Bodies, Ourselves. Judy Norsegian, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, it's a pleasure to join you, and I will acknowledge that we're in Cambridge right
now. Oh, you're in Cambridge.
We've been
okay.
All over the place. In fact, the very early meetings were in people's homes at MIT. It was in Watertown we had our first official office, but mostly we were in our homes for the first few years.
Oh, thank you for that correction, and actually I think it says a lot about the path that the organization has taken over time, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about that. So why don't you start by, in a way, taking us back to what the world was like in 1969, 1970, 1971, and why the book was needed. Because when I was looking back at the history, I mean, I remember where I was reading that some women were talking about how even just visiting the doctor, your obstetrician or gynecologist, was just a different experience than it is today. I wonder if you could just describe a little bit of what that world was like that led to Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Of course. Well, if you go back to the late 60s, many women were very concerned about reproductive rights. Abortion was illegal then. There was a tremendous amount of conflict that women experienced in their encounters with their doctors. Either they got no answers or they were chided for asking questions. You have to understand that 98% of obstetrician gynecologists were male back in the late 60s. They also had a fair amount of what I would call dysfunctional medical training, so that they thought of women in rather bizarre ways. We took a look at the OBGYN textbooks, and nowadays you'd laugh at the kind of language. Things like the core of the female personality consists of masochism, passivity, and female narcissism.
That was in medical text.
It was in a medical school text. It was actually in an OBGYN textbook, and it took some years to get the authors to take that language out of the textbook. But it's no wonder that there was this kind of attitude towards women. There was condescension, paternalism, sexism, and many women railed against that. That's why this workshop at that 1969 Women's Liberation Conference that was held, interestingly enough, at a Catholic college here in Boston, Emmanuel College, it's why the women continued to meet. They were galvanized by the conversation about health and sexuality and what little they knew about their bodies at that point. These were mostly college-educated women.
Interesting. And so, as you note, there was also sort of the backdrop of the women's movement as a whole, which was not yet in full flourish. But go ahead.
Well, no, absolutely. The women's health movement, which grew out of the second wave women's movement, was an important element, I think one of the more lasting elements of this second wave women's movement. But it was at conferences like this Emmanuel College event where women did come together, and they were electrified by all the topics that arose.
Well, tell me about those first meetings that the 12, I believe it was a group of about a dozen women who decided to take what they were taking from the conference, as you mentioned, and you know, met in the basement of a church, met in each other's homes. What was the conversation? What stories were they sharing, and how did that turn into Our Bodies, Ourselves, the book?
Yes, there was no intention to write a book at the very beginning. That's got to be made clear. Some of the women who met at this conference and continued to meet informally were struck by very bad experiences with doctors, say they had a sexually transmissible infection. In those days, we called it venereal disease. In fact, some women had their husbands told what the diagnosis was, and they weren't told. Other women had an illegal abortion, and they wanted to change that world. Other women had a postpartum depression. We didn't even have language for postpartum depression then, and they were told that they were just having trouble adjusting to their babies and to their marriage. So each woman had a different story to tell, and as they told these stories and shared their own experiences. And there was a lot about sexual relationships, about understanding female sexual pleasure. This was the days of Betty Dodson and liberating masturbation. And that's why that element in the book was so important when women discovered the book. It became a newsprint booklet after these months and periods of going back and forth and mimeographing little sections and having a community course, and people would add their own experiences. And eventually the women took it to the New England Free Press to put together this booklet, which came out not called Our Bodies Ourselves, but Women in Their Bodies, note the dissociation, mm-hmm. in December of 1970. It was early in 1971 it adopted this title.
Of Our Bodies Ourselves.
Yes.
Taking on a more sort of, it's about us.
It's about us,
title.
Exactly.
Now, I think the story of how the book came to be is so interesting, because knowing that it was women talking to each other, asking questions of each other, their own experiences, is one of the reasons why one of the hallmarks of Our Bodies Ourselves has been it's incredibly accessible. I mean, it's not written in medical language. It's not written in the language of psychiatry or feminist theory or whatever. It's just, it still feels like women talking to each other about issues.
Yes, and one of the problems was that primarily male experts were making pronouncements that weren't in fact accurate. And it wasn't just that we had this problem in society where women were supposed to be good and not ask questions and not speak out. It was that if you did not ask questions in the medical care encounter, you were more likely to have bad medical treatment. And physicians and women learn this quickly over time. And in the beginning, we were about demystifying medical care and educating ourselves. But as we got more sophisticated, as some of us went to schools of public health, we started to work more closely with public health researchers, with epidemiologists, with those who are beginning to do the research that needed to be done around women's health and sexuality.
Would you say that it was a deliberately activist book from the start?
Oh, of course. And it's a book with a point of view. It's clearly pro-choice. And there's, of course, one topic that, if anything, we've gone backwards in the last few years. And it's been always a contentious topic, the question of abortion and access to contraceptive services. But we've been, from the beginning, a book that has a point of view. It's a feminist book, although many people don't understand what feminism means if you look at the mainstream media's distortions. But we also don't tell women what to do. We give women the information, the best available information. We share what other women have done, and women are really left to make their own decisions.
Well, you said you don't encourage women about what to do, but there are very famous portions of the book that are very frank about encouraging literally self-examination, for example. I mean, there is the famous part of the book regarding a hand mirror and just women examining their own reproductive organs.
We do encourage women to take a look at themselves. And in fact, many nurse practitioners, even some physicians, now offer the mirror and the flashlight when there's going to be a regular GYN exam, because they understand, too, that when women are less mystified about their bodies, in the end, they were going to be better equipped to take care of their health.
Mm. And what I find very interesting about that is many women, when they first, and there have been a lot of recollections in the media about the 40th anniversary of the book, and a lot of women said, well, you know, just doing that, taking the mirror, doing the examination, it felt like a radical act, just figuring out who I am. Other women said it helped change my career path. The one thing which I noted in that first edition, I believe, in the book, it was actually written in that section, take a mirror and examine yourself. After all, you are your body and you are not obscene. Now, how radical was it just to state that plainly in 1971?
Well, it was tremendously radical. And even to this day, with all the mass media messages, with explicit sexual imagery, a lot of pornography, most women still feel uncomfortable about, quote, down there, have trouble speaking about it. And as you probably know, at our 40th anniversary, we featured our global partners from around the world. They have amazing stories to tell about the stigma that's attached to parts of a body. Women in Japan even changed the language so that the type of way we refer to intimate parts of our body wouldn't be pejorative, but more positive. And they got that into the dictionary, as a matter of fact. So there are great stories, but women continue around the world to struggle with this stigmatizing nature of women's bodies. And yet, at the same time, there's all this explicit and explicitly pornographic material that is now reaching young girls 4, 5, 6, 7 years old as we have this very hypersexualized climate.
I do want to talk about how the book itself has evolved and how its reach has grown and the new issues that have been rolled into recent editions, because it says a lot about how the culture has changed. But before we depart from the history entirely, I just want to ask you, I mean, remind us what reaction to the original editions of Our Bodies, Ourselves was like, because, you know, there's a very famous quote from Jerry Falwell, who was the leader of the Moral Majority, who did call it obscene.
Yes, obscene trash were his words. Well, in the very beginning, there were some physicians a little bit taken aback, but very quickly, physicians became partners. Physicians were very excited, actually, for the most part, that this kind of information was coming out and that we were calling for better research, that we still have areas where we need better research in certain topics in women's health. But it was the conservative right that really was deeply, deeply offended by the book, particularly after the Young Adult Service Division of the American Library Association in the 1970s chose Our Bodies, Ourselves as one of the best books for young adults of the previous 15 years. And it was at that point that the book got a lot of attention. Librarians came under attack. The right wing tried to get it out of schools, out of libraries. We spoke at Library Association meetings. We found many OBGYNs and adolescents and physicians to come forward with well-crafted letters to defend access to this book. It was not pornography. It was not obscene. It was the kind of basic information that young people especially needed. And they still need that, especially today, because there's so much misinformation out there.
Well, there are now 4 million copies of Our Bodies, Ourselves sold, 4 million plus. It's in more than 20 languages. Time magazine has listed it as one of the best and most influential 100 nonfiction books of our time. My guest is Judy Norsegian. She is executive director of Our Bodies, Ourselves. It is the 40th anniversary this year of the book that changed the way many women view themselves. I want to talk about what's in the book in this day and age, in the latest edition. But first, we've got a ton of callers who do want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We had a tweet from Judy Converse, who wrote, "The first edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves was such a big deal to me and my two sisters, we had to hide it under the bed. It so upset our dad." Let's take a call from Joan, who's calling from Brookline. You're on the air, Joan.
Hi. Well, I want to thank Judy. When I was 17 years old, we got that newsprint edition in New York City, you know. And we heard it came from somewhere up in the Boston area. And we used to have study groups. And we formed a coalition to bring sex education to the New York City high schools because all of this information was not available. Now, you know, 71 was the year before abortion was legal widely in the U.S., but it was legal in New York State. And the legality without the information actually was very problematic. To have an abortion in New York City meant you went to a major hospital. You were seen in the waiting room of an obstetrician with pregnant women, and you were given no counseling or information at all about what was happening to you. So many young women started to go to alternative sources of information, and there started to be conferences in New York City, mm-hmm. and generally knowledge that something was being translated. The first Our Bodies, Ourselves that we got, I still actually have that copy. It was so important to me, was actually a translation of material that previously had, from the gynecological text, had not been actually translated in language that women and young women could use to understand what was happening.
Joan, thank you so much for your call. Let me get Judy Norsegian to respond to that. What do you hear in Joan's story?
Well, of course, that was one of the things, the original group, and it wasn't just the 12 women, it was a fluid group, and it was 12 of us who incorporated in early 72, actually. We went to the Count Wayne Medical Library here at Harvard. We did some research. We talked to physicians and nurses who were responsive to our questions, and we tried to demystify, understand, and put in lay language this material that was in medical textbooks. But we also recognized that some of it had an overlay, pejorative overlay of attitudes towards women that really had to go. And so we were critiquing that as well. The book has always been very chock full of facts and information, and at the same time, very political. It has taken an advocacy perspective, and we really encourage our readers not only to make better decisions for themselves, but find out something in your community that gets you excited and work in groups to change the way things are.
Do you see those attitudes persisting in the same amplitude that they did in the early 70s, in the early editions of the book?
Well, things like sexism and condescension towards women, I think that that's changed quite a bit. Still exists, but not to the extent that we experienced it. I will say that sex education was practically non-existent, as the caller just mentioned. We had a huge problem with promoting better sexuality education in the schools, and we partnered sometimes with CECAS, which is based in New York. And then we had, more than 10, 15 years of abstinence-only sex education that the Republican administration spent hundreds of millions of dollars on, and it's led to a whole generation of young people who are badly misinformed, who go to medical school. I know this from one professor in Chicago, and say things like, you know, using condoms promotes HIV/AIDS. And that's because 4 years of college didn't disabuse this young person of the fact that that's a lie.
Well, that's some people who go to medical school, not all.
No. I'm just saying that that was a result, it turns out, of abstinence-only sex education in the high school.
Okay.
And I have met parents who didn't even know what their children were being told in the high school setting and were appalled when they looked at the curriculum materials.
Let's take another call. Noah is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Noah.
Hi, this is Noah. I'm one of the children of the authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves, and I first learned about sex and sexuality from Judy at her dining room table.
I know. It's good to hear you.
In about 1985.
Noah, tell us who the author is that you're related to.
My mother is Nancy Miriam Hawley, and I grew up very closely with the children of the other authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves.
And Miriam, and Noah's mother, actually co-led that workshop in 1969 at Emmanuel College.
So Noah,
I just wanted to publicly say thank you to the women who raised me and the kind of impact that it's had on my ability to be open about sex and health with women, but also with men, because I think the fact that any human being was having these kinds of conversations that were so taboo and not allowed and illegal in many places in the United States and the world has kind of paved the way for a lot more safety and safe sex and particular kind of sex education that wasn't going on anywhere else. So I just wanted to appreciate the authors in that way and also just kind of share what the impact has been as a child growing up around the conversations and seeing the book being edited and revised about every 5 years in the home that I grew up in. It takes a lot of work to do the work that Our Bodies, Ourselves does, and it's really important that we keep supporting the work and keep expanding it because it leads to a lot more benefits for people, not just in our own backyard, but around the world. I got to meet some of the global partners who are translating the book and doing the kind of work in their countries that was happening in the 70s here, and it's very inspiring, but it's still very new.
Noah, thank you so much for your call, because I want to pick up the point you made about the global reach of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Thank you so much for calling. When did, Judy Nursejian, when did Our Bodies, Ourselves first leave the United States, and what were the first countries that you put editions in globally?
Well, it got out pretty fast. In the early 70s, there was actually a pirated edition that came out in Taiwan. You know that they didn't observe copyright rules, and still probably don't. But there was also a Spanish language translation that we supported with some of our royalties income. The income never went into our pockets. It went into this nonprofit organization, which to this day is still struggling with all the work we've done. But we supported two women, one from Latin America and one from the United States, who produced the first in Western Cuerpos Nuestras Vidas. It since came out as a truly cultural adaptation in 2000. And then Japanese women were soon after, and there were many European editions that came out more or less as translations by groups of women. And then the real adaptations started later, the cultural adaptations that we're now supporting in many different countries.
You're supporting. I mean, were there ever cases, or are there ever cases, where Our Bodies, Ourselves has been culturally adapted for other countries to a degree which maybe you, as one of the original authors, wish it hadn't been in order to fit the cultural norms of that country?
Well, first of all, we don't read all these languages. The book is in Serbian, Bulgarian, Armenian. Now it's coming out in Turkish. It's the new editions in Hebrew and in Arabic have just come out, a group of Palestinian and Jewish Israeli women working together in Jerusalem. It's out in Nepal. It's out in India. The Bangla edition, of course, it's the fourth most spoken language in the world, but none of us read Bangla except one of our staff, possibly. So we have to trust that these women's groups and the team that they pull together do a good job. We're a technical advisor. We provide resources. We find sometimes experts who know these languages to work with them. But the editorial control is in the hands of these groups, and we assist them with fundraising to the best we can. They are the ones who are the best experts of what's needed in their regions, not those of us here in the United States.
Well, let me ask you what's in the current U.S. edition. Because, I mean, over the past 40 years, Our Bodies Ourselves has tackled issues, you know, abortion, birth control, masturbation, marriage, the whole thing. Are there issues that are in the recent edition that you couldn't have ever imagined would be something that would need discussion in Our Bodies Ourselves? I mean, you mentioned the hypersexualization of young girls.
Yes, and I would say in the early editions, we didn't have a chapter on body image. That's been only the later editions, and the current chapter on body image is spectacular and does take this issue on.
It even takes on plastic surgery.
Oh, well, that we've done for some time, and we have a great deal of material on, say, the risks of silicone gel breast implants. Most women don't learn much about this. And in fact, the industry and the plastic surgeons haven't collected adequate safety data on silicone gel breast implants, even since the days of when Commissioner of the FDA David Kessler called for such data to be collected. It still hasn't been collected. So we're actually encouraging women to get better informed. But it isn't just the question of body image and, of course, plastic surgery, which is the fastest growing specialty in medicine. It's also questions that surround sexual identity and gender orientation. We have a whole chapter on that topic that reflects an amazing conversation among so many people who contributed. More than 300 people participated in the production of this book. There's a new chapter on the perimenopause and menopause that gets into the controversy of bioidentical hormones, a chapter about the environment that looks at environmental toxics, that looks at the issue of global warming and its impact on reproductive health. So there's a lot of new material.
Well, ask about the young women in particular and the hypersexualization of girls, young girls, because it seems to be that part of the reason why that might be a growing aspect of young girlhood is because of, you know, mass media and the availability of imagery, information on Google, the number of ads that young people are subjected to. How is it that you deal with that issue in the book? And at the same time, I mean, it sort of gives rise to this other question of, does that mean that Our Bodies Ourselves is facing a relevancy question when women can get so much more information in other forms, in other media?
You know, I think that most adults now don't appreciate the barrage of extreme hypersexualized material, and it borders on pornography, that hits young 5, 6, 7-year-old kids, girls and boys. They're digesting this stuff every day, and they're not getting a lot of alternative images sometimes so that they can balance, you know, who is it that I want to be, and do I really want to be just eye candy? Are we returning to a time when women see themselves primarily as sex objects? I worry about things like this when I talk to younger women and teenagers, many of whom have joined the Spark Summit, a project in New York City trying to create a movement of resistance to this kind of imagery and to really encourage younger women to think of themselves as whole human beings, yes, entitled to sexual pleasure, yes, knowledgeable about these issues, but not thinking of themselves in such a narrow way.
Can a 900-page or almost 900-page book in this day and age hold its own against Google? Well, in terms of relevancy of information.
Well, the irony is that we resorted to a focus on our original sort of basic material, sexual and reproductive health, in an attempt to bring the book down in size, and it got bigger. It's more than 900 pages. But we have great links to our website, to other websites. It is £3 plus. It's hard to carry it around, but it's a terrific volume. I was on the editorial team with about 4 or 5 other people, and I didn't do most of the writing, but I was really impressed with the nature of the conversation. We had a wiki conversation where 37 people conversed over the course of a month, and it's very rich in that sexuality chapter.
I guess what in the last couple seconds we have, I'm asking about the Google question because, you know, when Our Bodies Ourselves first came out, it was a lone voice in the wilderness. But now there's so many other voices. So how would you say, you know, 10, 15 seconds, what is the relevancy of the book today?
There's a lot of misinformation, misleading stuff. Some of it is straight from pharmaceutical companies that are not giving balanced information. Our Bodies, Our Cells leads you to other reputable and trustworthy websites just like ours. So you really need help to sift out the good stuff.
Judy Norsegian, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being here and for 40 years of great work.
Thank you, Mitnick.
Judy Norsegian is the executive director of Our Bodies, Ourselves. There will be a panel discussion and book signing Tuesday night at 7 p.m. in Cambridge at Porter Square Books. You can also find an excerpt of the 40th edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves on our website, radioboston.org. And listeners, there were so many of you who wanted to share your questions. I'm sorry I couldn't fit you all in. So hop online at radioboston.org and do share your stories there. Stay with us because coming up, Boston Rockabilly with Roy Sludge. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.